Hello and welcome to Running Dialogue, a podcast about movies. My name is Kurt Holman and I write for Creative Loafing. And this week, the podcast for movies is actually a podcast about television with kind of a nod towards movies because we're basically, you know, surrendering ourselves to the phenomenon of Lost, which is entering its final season ahead of summer movies. And this is also an excuse not to talk about Furry Vengeance or The Nightmare or Nightmare on Elm Street, the remake, which opened today because...
It's garbage.
Yeah, yeah, and our souls have been beaten already, those of us who've seen those. So, my guest this week, we have a special guest that I will let introduce when we go around the table. So if you guys want to jump in.
Yes, I'm Matt Goldberg. I'm the managing editor of Collider.com.
Matt's not the special guest, and neither am I. I'm Russ Fisher from Slash.
I'm always special, goddammit.
Yeah, they're the special regulars, yeah.
And I'm Allison Keane, the token female and blogger for Lost.
Yeah, Allison writes the televangelist episode reviews of Lost, which are like more popular than most of the things I write for Creative Loafing. So we wanted to get her in here. One thing I want to say is that Russ actually has watched Lost probably the ideal way to watch Lost. And why don't you tell us how you watched Lost?
I'd never seen the show until about 2 months ago, at which point I basically mainlined the first five seasons. I had an afternoon free. I saw that they were all available on DVD, and I figured, or actually on Netflix streaming. And I figured, well, if I start now, I can maybe catch up and be able to watch the conclusion in real time with everyone else. So I get kind of the best of both worlds. I get to see the whole show. I get to see it on my own terms. But then I get to have the excitement and the fun of, you know, watching how angry everyone is inevitably going to be when the show ends and doesn't give them what they want.
And you can probably enjoy the when you weren't watching the show, the people who were, and like, can you believe it? The season finale ended, and we didn't find out what was in the hatch and stuff like that.
Well,
you know,
so, I mean, I've managed to remain relatively ignorant despite having a few close friends who, I mean, a couple of my closest friends are gigantic Lost nerds, like to a degree that's almost unfathomable. Like one of my friends named his production company after a line that's at the end of season three,
and which is
not Penny's boat, and you know, it's like I have a bunch of friends who are really into it, and I've kind of stayed at arm's length, and I didn't really know very much. I mean, I knew the very basics, and that was it. And so I went in almost as cold as it was possible to go, and you know, speaking as someone who is a convert in that sense, I really enjoyed it. Was mm-hmm. really taken with the way the show presents itself, the way it builds characters, the way it dangles plot in order to keep you on the hook for characters. And so I'm right there with it.
Yeah. One thing I want to say about that, and it sometimes I feel like the person who states the obvious in these conversations, but the obvious thing this week is that TV is so good on DVD because, you know, the commercials are gone, which is, you know, obviously, you know, duh. But because TV shows, you know, are designed to kind of like end with like rising action before the commercial breaks. So on DVD, it's like the speed bumps are off. So there, I find TV shows sometimes easier to watch than movies. Even if you had like two shows, would be easier than a similar movie, just because there's that kind of intensity and the momentum is so much more fast for me.
Well, you know? I've watched Lost both ways. I own all the DVDs, but I watch it episode to episode, and it just plays really differently. And I think it plays great both ways because, you know, that weekly episode ends and you're like, ah, but you also have like that time to sort of, you want to, you know, venture guesses like what comes next week and so like that. And sure, on the DVD, you're like, I'm going to go straight to it. But sort of having that time and the excitement and sort of being in the moment, I really enjoy. That being said, when you play through on DVD and sort of marathon it, it becomes more, I guess, it moves from being a television show that feels cinematic to a really long movie.
Yeah.
And it has a completely different feel to it, but it's also great that way. Mm-hmm. So I like Lost both on DVD and as a weekly series.
Well, yeah. A couple weeks ago I talked about, I don't know if you guys have seen Life on Mars, the UK show.
Yes, I have.
So that's one, and I get really spoiled because I watch a lot of TV on DVD, so the week-to-week to me is just like this agonizing experience. And when I was watching Life on Mars, that's a show where, like Lost, you know that you're building up to there's a big mystery and there's going to be a big reveal at the end, and you know that you're not not going to be necessarily entirely satisfied by it, but at the same time, you're just, you can't wait to get to it. So I was flying through those DVDs. I mean, I was like on season two in like 2 days, and just, you know, by the end,
it's all
over.
And there's only two seasons. Yeah. They're very short.
They're very short, and I like that. I support that, actually. Yeah. But I came to the end, and it was over, and I sat there, and I thought, God, I didn't pay that much attention to the rest of the show, because I was so focused on the mystery and how it was going to resolve itself. And, you know, the way I came to Lost was similar to Russ, in that my first episode is actually The Constant, which was a great one to start with.
Just to see, when did y'all get into the series? Because I've watched it since the pilot.
Okay, I watched it since the first season DVD came out, right ahead of the second season premiere.
Okay.
So, and I'll just sort of jump
so
in.
So I'm the early adopter. What up?
You knew what was going on.
I win.
Yeah.
No.
But for me, it's like...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
if I could just stick this in you finish it.
So polite now, yeah. I feel. But anyway, so I, you know, the first episode was The Constant. I sort of got sucked into it because all my friends were huge fans. And I watched it. I thought, this show isn't that bad. And so then I did the binge, you know, to finish up season four. And then week to week, though, even though it is infuriating, it sort of makes you consider the show a little more deeply rather than just focusing on, like, my God, can we just get to the end and find out what the smoke monster is and what the island is and this and the other. And it just, the reveals are a lot slower, and I feel like a lot more rewarding in that sense. Yeah. So,
well, the funny thing for me was, like, when I sort of alluded to this when talking about how Russ watched it. I didn't watch the first season, but I would read about it in Entertainment Weekly back when I subscribed to that. And people would talk about, you know...
You killed magazines. You know,
exactly. I'm as guilty as anyone. But
now he just reads it online.
You know, it's like, I saw people, like, complaining. It's like, they opened the hatch at the end of the season, and they didn't say what was in it. How outrageous! You know, and I was like, whatever. Then I watched the show, and I showed what happened. It's like, well, okay. But it didn't bother me, because then the second season started.
It has that amazing opening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then the end of the second season, it's like, well, they get captured by the others, but tell us anything about the others that we hadn't already known. And then the third season was, I think, like six episodes kind of by themselves, and they end up with another thing.
And they aired that way.
Yeah. And I was like resolving to quit watching the show because I was so frustrated. And then by the time the show would be back on, it's like, yeah, I'll just watch it again. And then would fall in love with it all over again and stop being as frustrated with it. And I think I developed an equanimity in appreciating its mysteries and things like that.
And actually, after the end of season three, first they said, okay, we've developed the end point. We're going to do 4, 5, and 6, and that's the end. Mm-hmm. And also, when we air this show, we're going to start airing it in January, start to finish.
Yeah.
No breaks. Mm-hmm.
Except for
this week. Yeah, there's usually that one week. Yeah. And you're like, then what was the point, ABC? What was the point?
I also question ABC's point in their promos a lot of times. They're just so... And I mean, one thing I think, speaking about like the revealing of the various mysteries and things, is I think a lot of times they really overplay their hand. Mm-hmm. I mean, by the time something is revealed, it's like, well, I kind of guessed it anyway. It's like, when, you know, who's Jeremy Bentham and all this, it's like, we all knew it was... I don't know if I can spoil that for people.
We're talking openly about it. Up to, like, halfway through the season. But we'll say that...
Snape killed Dumbledore!
Yeah.
It was gay.
We'll say that Russ has watched through the Ricardos episode, but not after that, so we won't reveal stuff that comes after that. But
I don't even remember anything. I've just been so annoyed the past few weeks. I don't even, like, besides that, which they reran this week in the off week, it's like, oh, well, let's do the Richard episode, because that was the last awesome one.
Well, I actually, you know, what's funny is actually I'm one of the people that I liked the Richard episode, but I wasn't as crazy about it as everyone else, because I think they wasted a good 15 minutes. Like, I mean, this is a show that really needs to start getting
love.
To well, no, not just like, yeah,
riding
this is like
horse through the rain,
perfect,
that was for the ladies.
Yeah, perfect dead wife syndrome, which we've seen before. Like, the person I loved who's dead and perfect in every way, and right. I have to do everything for them. But the thing that really got me about that episode is they spent like an entire quarter of it showing that, yes, it was difficult to get off the ship. Right. He just couldn't do it. He's like, I struggled a lot, and this nail didn't work, and then a pig came by.
Everything was thrown at him.
It's funny. I wasn't going to mention this, but you said that. And one thing about the last season, someone else made this comparison. I think it was whoever reviews for The Vulture, comparing Lost the season to the Stephen King's novel The Stand, where if you've read it, it's like it has like basically a disease wipes out most of humanity, and America's survivors divide up into two camps, you know, with like this kindly African-American woman who's very old, and kind of the good people gravitate towards her, and the evil people, or just kind of the flawed people, you know, gravitate towards this guy who's basically the devil. Yeah. And there's a scene in one of those in the book where a guy's in jail and starving, mm-hmm. and Randall Flagg, the man in black in The Stand, comes and lets him out. It felt very much... The Richard scene in the hold felt real inspired
by
that.
Yeah. Well, let's maybe to provide a little bit of structure, mm-hmm. and I'll throw this at Allison because she's the resident sort of blogger of Lost, et cetera. Maybe we should talk about sort of the appeal of the show in general and how that's evolved into the appeal or lack thereof of this season. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's actually something I addressed in my blog last week, as a matter of fact. The fact that, why are we so angry, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, it's just this response, and I've actually gotten to the point
I'm not angry, by the way.
Neither am I.
Really?
Okay. You're the only one who's angry.
I'm so angry. It's actually, you know, because how I've started watching this season, trying to get, like, other perspectives while the show's actually going on is, I mean, I'll keep an eye to, like, the Twitter feed, what people are kind of, you know, the hashtag Lost, whatever, and I get on GChat and chat with, like, all my friends during the commercials, and it's a lot of, you know, just like, WTF this, and like, OMG that, but people are just really, I mean, almost everyone I know, when I post the blog up, a lot of people are commenting, like, I started DVRing this, and I watch it when I can remember, but I don't even care anymore. It's just... It's interesting to me, and I sort of threw this out at the readers last week, was, you know, what is it about the show that resonates so much? Like, why is it that we care so deeply about the show? And I'm going to say this at the risk of alienating everyone, is that Lost is a good show, but to me, it's not a great show. It could be better.
We're done here.
This interview is over.
Yeah, cut her mic.
But it's interesting, because I'm throwing it out to you guys to say, like, you know, I mean, I wouldn't put it in my, like, top 10 of the decade or something like that. It'd probably be in the top 15, maybe, okay, but like, I just, there's something about it. I don't know if it's the network aspect, the fact that there was a lot of filler for a while when they didn't know when the end date was and that sort of thing. But I mean, just for you guys, I mean, what why does the show sort of resonate for you?
For me, what it is, and I sort of glanced at this earlier when I was talking about getting into the show, is it's the way that it uses plot hooks to keep you on the track of these characters and to reveal character. And it's, you know, this notion of, I'm not so interested in like the good versus evil thing. And I do see the show as more of chaos versus order, you know, which has been made very explicit in recent episodes, which made me happy. But, it's really about the characters for me and seeing how they can sort of look at various iterations of the same character and explore facets of these core people that they've set up. You know, a guy like Locke, who is a guy who's, you know, faith over reason, but not exclusively. And you know, there's a lot of nuance in these people, and I think the show addresses that in a really interesting way. And I think that the sideways timelines now are that's going on, or the sideways timeline is a way of sort of reinforcing that and going back to, like, okay, what are the core natures of these people? Who do they think they are? Mm-hmm. Who do they want to be? And who, like, where's the connective point between those? And using the stuff that you get out of those little nuggets to say, okay, this is kind of where the show's going for the end game.
You are like Darlton's most perfect viewer. Yeah. That's what they want. Like, season 5 is all about the relationships. I'm like, I want more time travel. And like, they're like, that's a red herring.
Well,
forget about that.
I love the time travel. The time travel is great.
I know, but that's to the core of the show, and that's what, you know. So, yeah. But go ahead, Matt.
Well, the thing that's kept me hooked is, yeah, the mysteries are very interesting, but what's kept me a Lost viewer is characters. I care about the characters, and I think Lost is ultimately a character-based show. We got into it because of each episode is based around a particular character, mm-hmm. pretty much, and we see, you know, their origin stories. And I love origin stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that
even Stranger in a Strange Land. Don't tell me you like that episode because I will reach across this table and strike.
Which episode
you.
Was
Jack's,
Jack's
tattoos?
Oh,
who cares? No, their characters.
I.e., okay, the worst episode of the series.
Right.
No, their characters. I do not. Like, I'm not going to be ever going to be like a huge Jack fan or a Kate mm-hmm. fan, but there are characters who I really do like, and I like following them. But more than that, I just like seeing how people become the way that they are. And if there's something I have been frustrated with the sideways timeline, is that the thing that I'm taking away from it is that it feels like, well, yes, if we had made different choices in life, our lives would be different as a result.
Right.
I mean, it's not a huge revelation. I do agree, you know, with Russ, it's sort of like, what is the core of these people?
Right.
You know, and we've sort of seen that. Sawyer is still clever. He's still driven by this, you know, trying to find the man who essentially killed his parents. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, now he's a cop. He's using his cleverness for something else, and
he's conflicted. He's conflicted between this sense of self-serving aggression and a certain self-indulgence, and the sense that at the real core, he's actually pretty good and he's willing to help people. And that's sort of one of the core, you know, with Saeed's episode, where you see, okay, he wants to transcend his nature, but at the core, what he's, you know, when he's pushed into a certain place, he's going to kill. He's going to be a violent guy. Mm-hmm. And that's what he really is, whether he wants to be that or not. And we're being reminded of these things in very short little bursts. Like, no, this is what's really going
on.
And
they said, I mean, the creator said, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, they said, going into this season, what we've really tried to go back to is season one and the way we structured it. And it's funny because even in the first few episodes, you had LA space X, right. But then you had a Kate episode, a Locke episode, and a Jack episode. And actually that was the order that they kicked off the very first season. Yeah. And I definitely do think it's trying to go back to these core values. Mm-hmm. And again, that's why I'm always going to be interested in Lost, because it's such a character-driven show. Mm-hmm. As much as, you know, we have all the mysteries. And I think ultimately, you know, while people are like, oh, you know, this, you know, the finale is going to be, you know, it's going to disappoint. They're not going to have all the answers. Personally, I think, A, you should just be prepared to not get all the answers you want. And B, they've said there is no single unifying theory of Lost. They have also said we're not going to give you every answer. To me, what I want to see is, what happened to these characters? What if the show can remain true to them and sort of tell me what happened to them? I care more about their endings than, you know, what is the smoke monster and things like that. Yes, I've actually written down a list. Questions I have, and maybe you guys want to talk about them that I think are interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm sorry, Kurt. Yeah, you go on. Did I just ramble for 18 minutes?
Cut the nerd off. Cut him off.
they try to do that every week.
one thing. To go back kind of an aspect of Russ's question is that what's interesting about the show is that it's been such a popular phenomenon of a show. Yeah. That's such a weird show. It's like, you think about what kind of – if you try and categorize it, it's like, I guess it's a science fiction adventure, almost like an Irwin Allen show. But that doesn't seem at all right. So it's kind of a testament to the power of the mysteries and how well they've sustained them that it's kept the interest so long just on that level. Because, I mean, it seems like a show that would be like, well, these nerdy critics love it and, you know, everyone else is like, I'm going to watch, you know, Grey's Anatomy or something like that. You
right.
know?
Something horrible. Like
yeah.
Grey's Anatomy.
Right. Well, go on.
But one thing about kind of the mysteries in this season is that I feel like I've gotten answers to nearly every mystery, you know. I don't have a lot of questions. Some things they haven't really explained in words so much, but it's like, I don't know exactly what the island is, but we kind of know what it does and how it's kind of unstuck in time in this interesting way. And we know kind of what the smoke monster and Jacob are by seeing what they do and how to interact with other people. Mm-hmm. So I'm also at the point where I don't want too many more explanations, because in the Richard episode when they said, you know, well, he's basically the devil, you know, and it's like, well, I don't know if I want him that much of a label and that's the one thing about the season that's kind of disappointed me a little bit, is just that it seems so much like good and evil.
Well, right.
But I've been enjoying it as watching these contending forces go on as like a, you know, serial adventure, fine. And I don't feel frustrated just because it's like, okay, well, it's just going to go along and I'm going to enjoy this for what it is. I don't really like the fact that, like, Saeed's character is sort of like this zombie. He's like evil because it's like, well, what?
One thing, though, about getting back to season one is that there are so – I mean, here's the thing. All right, we've got our core cast, right? What is up with, like, Dogen and the temple and, like, this bootleg Tina Fey? Who are these people? I don't need them. I'm annoyed by the regular cast. Like, they could kill Kate and Claire and all. Like, I could name, like, five right now. I could get rid of it.
Yeah. Well, this show really hates hippies. I've discovered that over the season. Just smelly hippies are the worst.
They just keep adding so many characters. Yeah. I feel like someone like Saeed or some of these characters are not getting their due. I mean, they might have one line in an episode, or they might not appear for two or three episodes. And I've sort of lost whatever it is that I felt for them because I no longer, like, in season season one, you kind of got a sense of like, okay, who are these people and their struggles and where they come from? And now it's sort of like, I don't even know if I care anymore because
they definitely dispersed everyone too much in the opening episodes. You had people at the temple, and then you had, you know, right. Hurley and Jack going to the lighthouse, and then you had, you know,
they kept missing each other too.
You had Locke's
back. But Jack was just here. Yeah. Now he's
like, exactly. So you had to keep breaking people up, and I think, you know, recently they finally began to reconverge them, which I can't keep saying things because.
But at the risk of really becoming the nerd, you know, the fact that they kept missing each other and that, hey, Jack was just here is very much part of the point. You know, it's the whole idea of, you know, again, order versus chaos and the ways in which everyone's personal desires intersect with what they should really be doing and what's good for the group in general. And I like the fact that, okay, the good versus evil, yeah, whatever. But I like the idea that people are switching sides, and that they are switching sides, you know, based on some weird nexus of their own interest and what they think their responsibilities are. And because I see that happening, I've got this faith that it's going to build to something, that it's going to show me something that isn't just like, oh, you know, the smoke monster and the man in black and the devil are all the same.
Right. It's purgatory and there.
Right. Yeah. Well, and
it's Hurley's dream.
I really like what Russ said about sort of order versus chaos, because to me that's far more interesting than good versus evil.
Oh, yeah, no question.
Because, and also because I don't necessarily see the smoke monster as all evil. I think
it's not so black and white.
Even though they're dressed in black and white.
Despite that.
Also, and Jacob, I don't think is, you know,
good.
He's pure good. I mean,
he's kind of a prick.
He's a manipulative prick, and his followers are assholes.
Yeah. But he's, you know, manipulating people to an end that he thinks is more valuable than those individuals are. And if, you know, he's like, and that's the whole order thing. It's like
determination, you know, versus free will.
Right. Exactly. You know, or, you know. There's almost a weird like fascism thing in there where he's like, no, you have to, everybody has to give up something to achieve this, and if we don't give up something, it's meaningless because it's all going to go away anyway.
It's communism.
Yeah.
It's
it is
for
communism.
The greater good.
Exactly.
What?
Yeah. One thing that might be the thing that might be cultivate frustration in the show is part of the fact that, like going back the past couple of seasons, you know, the characters were separated in time in these crazy ways where, you know, half of the ones were back in the mainland and the other half were in 1977 on the island, you know. So think about, it's like, okay, so how long have they, you just kind of keeping all that in your head is kind of confusing. One thing about, like, any show that goes on this long, though, is, like, it might reveal the limitations of some of the actors. And, like, on the early scenes, it's like, Evangeline Lilly, she's cool. I'm into her. And then it's like, she doesn't have that much.
Like,
although
she's going
she's
on. Hot.
In her defense, Kate episodes. in her defense, Kate episodes are always boring.
They're so
she
bad.
Really
they
never
worst.
Got a chance to showcase herself. Matthew Fox is too, it's so easy to make fun of him. I don't necessarily.
Have you seen all the Jack faces? That they there's, like, a, there's a wiki page for Jack faces where they have everyone, people are making
like
gifts from, like, you know, like jeers, you know, like the Jack tears or, like, you know, the it's
when my,
like,
when
know,
my, he
so,
always looks like he's about to cry.
Yeah.
And like a little tremble.
And when he's upset, he kind of like looks up and then looks down, you know. So
he's doing the old George Clooney thing.
Yeah.
Before Steven Soderbergh cured Clooney of the, like, the head down, eyes up.
And the head bobble.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Like that.
But the thing, like, to me, I've just gotten to the point where I don't even pay that much attention to Kate and Jack as characters. They are their propulsion to me, their momentum. They are, you know, Jack is reliable in the sense that he will always take action against things. He moves the story
although
forward.
He's actually, you know? They have actually transformed him in an interesting way, I think, this season.
Yeah, there's been stuff going on with him that gets beyond the basic daddy issues and, you know, into the...
And I have to be the hero and I have all the answers when...
Right.
A lot of the time I don't. And
right.
So I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
One of my favorite characters is Sawyer because I was always captivated by him because, you know, he seemed to see himself as a bad person, but actually he was good. He was fighting against his good nature. And eventually he sort of accepted the fact that he was a good person and a smart person. And you definitely saw that in season 5. Mm-hmm. And I love that moment. There's a moment where sort of Jack comes in. He's like, what are we doing? What are we going to do now? It's like, you're just reading a book. And so he's like, you know, Winston Churchill read a book every night during the Blitz. So I'm going to sit here and think about what we're going to do. And you can go fuck straight off.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I didn't really like Sawyer as much early on because because, you know, he's such a jerk, so you know, he's not very likable early on. But he's become like more of a man of action who's like trying to like solve things in a way that Jack hasn't been so much lately. So, you know, it's kind of interesting that they've had that kind of switch almost.
Well, Jack has always been reaction. He's always been, here's the short-term solution. Here, this is what we need to do now so that this doesn't happen. And so we're going to do this, and then I'm going to figure it all out later. And then there's always something else that becomes the thing that has to be done now, and he never really figures it all out later. And that's, you know, kind of the classic character flaw, the core character thing of Jack. So.
But the possibility of a Sawyer Miles buddy cop spinoff the greatest potential to come out of this show yet.
That was one of the sideways plotline things I thought was a little cute. You know,
there were like, quite
really both. You know, I mean,
Faraday playing the piano. But
I do. You know, the show is really good at throwing out these little characters that become a lot more meaningful than you expect them to be. Like, you know, Miles, like Faraday, who
the freight crew.
Exactly. You know, those guys, or, you know, any number of these people.
That was
who,
Ben. Ben was only intended to be a few episodes, and they just liked Michael Emerson so much.
Yeah.
Now Ben he's this huge player.
Yeah. And it's funny, though, speaking about Ben. Sorry.
Please go ahead.
Before the season started, my friends and I had joked about doing a Lost draft, like a fantasy football style thing. And we were going to have this elaborate set of, you know, point systems and all that. And I was, the whole time, I was like, my number one pick is going to be Ben, because he is such a badass. And I have loved him since he was Henry Gale. And he's just been this, like, you know, just crazy who he's with. And he just pansied out in this season. I mean, he's been kind of cool and kind of there, but he has not been like, I would have lost a lot of points for picking Ben.
That's fascinating.
Like,
it's been really interesting. Him, you know, it's like there's that crux of
give
a moment
up that power.
Where, you know, he you know, tries to have it both ways. He tries to, you know, save his daughter and keep his power, and he basically fails on both counts. And
that might be my favorite actual sideways plot.
I mean, you know, well, the side
in season four.
But then when they replayed it, and then he made the choice again.
He makes the right choice.
And I think that's why it resonated, because like, oh,
absolutely, yeah. And his fall is fascinating to me, and, you know, watching him kind of run around the beach with his arms flapping like a, you know, a drunk, like, penguin in season six, and being kind of like, well, where do you want me to go now? Please don't shoot me. I love that, because it's, you know, he's got an incredible character arc that you don't often get the chance to see in either TV or movies. And you get, with him, you get in so much detail, and he's so good at playing it that it's that, I mean, that justifies the entire series as far as I'm concerned.
Matt, you had some questions that you want us to think about,
okay.
Right?
I wrote some down, but I'll just narrow it down to like the ones that are really ones bugging me. The first one is, who were / are Adam and Eve? From the caves in the very, very first episode, they discovered two bodies, one male, one female.
Bernard and Rose, of course.
Right.
Perhaps.
Yeah. There's a theory that's who they are. Right. But
and they have a pouch with a black stone and a white stone, which represents Jacob and the Man in Black.
Yeah. Right.
When we must assume now, knowing more about it. I don't know who they are.
Yeah. So, and then another one is, at the end of season five, we saw how Jacob touched each person. He touched... particular people, and we found out that all of them are candidates except for Kate. Mm-hmm. Kate's name is not written in the cave wall. She's not one of the numbers. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of wondering, you know, well, is she special? Like, why isn't her name on the wall?
It's interesting that Jacob seems to have female bodyguards, which was a theory I read, because he had Alana, he had... I can't even remember. I should have prepared better. So Kate, like, the theory was possibly Kate was... supposed to be a bodyguard of some kind.
For whoever does end up
is, you know, potentially the candidate. Although my head almost exploded when I heard that. I was like, then why is she here? She's not a candidate. What have we been doing? Why does she have...
And does he actually touch... Does Jacob actually touch Kate?
Yep. When she's a kid.
He does, yeah.
He touches her nose. Right.
Yeah. It sounds so out of context. So yeah. Did Jake...
Yeah, it's like, so did he touch her in her nose?
Let's go back to Nightmare on Elm Street.
Show on the doll where Jacob touched
exactly. Yeah. I kind of want to make that. I sort of want to make the lost CSI kit. Yeah. The lost abuse kit.
Right. And my final question is sort of, and I think this is going to be one of the things we don't get an answer to, is what was the deal with Walt? You know,
that's my number one.
Why was he special? Why does he have special powers? Mm-hmm. Why did the others want him? What tests did they sort of run on him? Mm-hmm. Things of that nature. And I think that we're just sort of out of time. And I think that they just sort of had to let Walt go.
I was hoping he would be the one that they found, and when when the tower was moving to that one spot, and who are they calling back? I was like, well, I was doing my Michael impression, like, whoa, like that's who I wanted to come back.
That was my favorite little Lost chat roulette thing. Was that somebody put together a JPEG that was, you know, fake chat roulette windows with Michael in one window and Walt in the bottom. And it's like, Dad? Walt? Dad? Walt!
Someone had a Walt Count website, actually, where I can't remember how many episodes before but it was like at the highest point was maybe like 22 Walts in one episode, like screaming, Walt! Walt! Walt!
Incredible.
Give it back, my son. And it took my boy. Yeah.
But okay. It's not that they had to let Walt go. It's that they had to let Walt grow.
I understand.
Seriously, the actor, the kid, it's amazing.
He showed up in season five.
He's in season five when Locke goes to New York and Locke sees him.
Right.
And there's kind of a sign off there. It's like, dude, wanted to see you.
Right.
Yep. Doing okay, Locke.
Sorry.
Okay.
Enjoy the rest of the show.
Exactly. And that's another thing is, we've seen Walt reappear on the island briefly. He appeared to Shannon and Saeed, mm-hmm. and he appeared, to Locke while Locke was kind of dying. And he's like, Walt was like, get out of the damn hole and get your shit together. But, but he's not, I can't. There's something I really want to say, and it's you're not there yet, Russ.
Okay.
And it's
go ahead and say it.
Okay. I don't care.
We've learned that the smoke monster is dead people. It was Christian Shepherd. Mm-hmm. It's people who are dead that appear to them. But Walt obviously isn't dead. It wasn't the smoke monster appearing as Walt. Because if the smoke monster could appear as people who are alive, then that would just ruin the show. It would just be like, why didn't he just appear as this person to trick that person?
Right.
But if these only can be people who are dead.
Right. I basically knew that anyway, too. So don't.
That's the sort of thing where it's like, when it was revealed,
is
it really revealed?
But it was confirmed.
It's like, obviously, obviously Christian had to be the smoke monster. Obviously, Richard's wife was the smoke monster. Mm-hmm. Things like that. So it's like, when she appears to him on the Black Rock, obviously that's...
Oh, yeah. I thought you meant like at the end of the episode.
No, at the end of the episode, I think that was genuinely... her and Hurley, again, that's sort of the interesting line between Hurley. Hurley's that kind of really awesome character where he's kind of this margin walker in a way.
He's also like, the audience surrogate.
Yeah.
He
the
says
voice,
everything
yeah.
we
oh, yeah.
want to yeah. say and.
Yeah.
Yeah,
in a way, we would say, like, dude, what's up with that?
That great episode where he tries to explain everything that's happened so far to, like, his mom or something, and she's like, I don't know.
Yeah. But I'm with you. Yeah. She's like, but whatever, if you believe that this is happening, and I believe you too. And she was everybody's mom in that episode.
I want to say, to jump back to your questions, there was a question I had that I don't think was ever resolved, but one of the things that drove me so crazy about the third season, where I think Jack was like a kind of the outdoor Planet of the Apes prison of the others, and like the I think the stewardess was there and talking to them,
right.
and so she was obviously with the others,
right.
and he didn't ask her questions like, why are you with the others? I mean,
right.
they had this kind of ambiguous exchange. It's like,
there's not a lot of great communication on the Lost Island. People will just get together after not seeing each other for, 32 years and just be like, so what do we do next? It's like, why don't you communicate on where you've been?
Yeah.
Because you guys don't know what's been going on.
And so it was almost it was almost a sense that they had so little sense of the writers of like where it was going to go that they didn't want to reveal too much because they weren't there yet.
Right.
And I remember just being like,
but Cindy's
Jack
interesting
would be asking
too.
Things,
Cindy's a weird case as well because we really don't know.
And
sort
that's
of what,
the stewardess, right?
Yeah. Right, right, yeah.
And so it's like, why were they stealing the people and what happened to them and why did they hang out with the others? I don't think they ever really got to that. I don't think they will explain it at
right.
this
and
point.
And I was actually wondering, I guess it's two things. Richard sort of becomes Jacob's man on the island, his fourth person. So presumably he built the following, but from who? Who did he build the following over the year? And why does Jacob have sort of a representative and the smoke monster doesn't? Because the smoke monster seemed like he could just tell Richard what to do, so why can't he just convince someone else and build their own factions?
But he does. It's like the smoke monster's representative is himself – disguised as other people,
his representative like an army as sort of like Jacob has. He doesn't have like a temple and things of that nature.
Right. Yeah, but he's a smoke monster.
He's a smoke monster.
Yeah, he's like, I don't need other people.
He has under the temple.
Yeah. But yeah, no, one thing they haven't revisited.
He's the thing in the basement that no one wants to talk about.
They haven't revisited. For a while, a really big plot point was not being able to have a baby on the island, right? For just ever and ever, it was like, you know, and then Sun had the baby, and then it was all this. But this is something they really haven't revisited at all. Like, they took the kids, and now these kids are others.
And why,
like,
was Aaron special? Why did they want him?
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to get answers to much of those things.
That's one of those things where, I mean, I think some people have speculated, like, the statues have something.
Because it was a statue of fertility.
Statue of fertility, but destroyed.
I had
a friend who said, like,
I'd buy that, okay.
I have a friend, though, who's like, I don't know if it's fair to have a show where you have to go to Wikipedia to understand.
Or Lostpedia, I think
it is. And that's one of the things that I think is really interesting about Lost, mm-hmm. is it is very much a modern show in that sense. And it reminds me, and if you've seen this movie, it's going to sound like such a bad touchstone, but it reminds me of Southland Tales. In that...
You've ruined everything.
See,
this podcast is over for the second time.
Southland Tales, Richard Kelly's follow-up to Donnie Darko. It's a bad movie. But it's a bad movie with a lot of potential, and it's a bad movie with a lot of good ideas. And it's a bad movie that becomes a lot better if you watch it with your laptop open and you're kind of referencing mm-hmm. all of these supplementary materials that went along with it. If you reference the website that they built for it, if you reference Wikipedia and look at all of these references that people have compiled and all that, and doing so, it becomes a very different thing than it becomes just watching it on its own. And Lost, I think, is very much like that. You know, it's like you see whether it's like, hey, okay, Jacob is sitting there reading this Flannery O'Connor book, or, you know, or Ben is given a copy of Valis by Philip K. Dick to read, mm-hmm. or, you know, this song, particular song is playing. You know, it's like, you know, even anything like, wow, that's kind of rad that Sawyer's all drunk and pissed off and he's listening to Raw Power by Iggy and the Stooges. Like, that's awesome. Yeah. But to me, it's... You know, I hate the term postmodern when used in this sense, but that's kind of what it is, because it's the storytelling that reaches beyond the simple boundaries of television and goes into other media and invites you back to make those connections back and forth.
And I actually do like that when it sort of, you know, you can understand something, but if you want to sort of further, you know, your knowledge and get some new clues, you can go there. My problem with the fertility statue thing is that seemed like such a major plot point. Like, I mean, they carried it on so long about why, you know, women couldn't have babies on the show, and right. now it seems like something that we won't get to. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, like, there are going to be questions we just don't get answered, and that seems like it's going to be one of them.
I mean, one thing that I tell people that have never watched the show and I just hate it irrationally because it's like everyone watches it, I must hate it, which is how I felt for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I get it. But I'm, you know, so what is the value of the show? Like, what's great about it? And I said, to me, one of the best things is that it actually creates a discourse. People are thinking and talking about something that, you know, it's not so mindless. It actually creates, you know, and for a lot of people, friends of mine, and Kurt, you sort of touched on this as far as it being so popular. I mean, the kinds of people that watch Lost, like the gambit of viewers is so interesting, and to have all these people come together and talk about it and to really, like, engage the brain for a TV show. I mean, this is what excites me about this, because people are going on Wikipedia and looking stuff up, and yeah, maybe it's related to the show or maybe it isn't, but they're learning something, and I'm learning stuff.
You might find out about that Jeremy Bentham was
a philosopher.
I know.
He was dead and propped up in a public place for years.
Two of the main characters are John Locke and Desmond David Hume.
Right.
Exactly.
Right,
yeah.
I mean, I've learned a lot, you know, from my wiki travels. But
one thing, but this speaks a little bit to the other thing, the point I want to make about, you know, contemporary television is that it's really kind of perfected the art of the big arcing narrative, which mm-hmm. is something that movies can't do for reasons of time, you know. So
well, there used to be those serials, though. And
yeah, right. but
no, but you're right that this is something so much more wide spanning.
Yeah,
those could ever.
But
be.
This is what I think. I really this is, you know, I don't know, but I think that the miniseries is going to have a comeback in the mm-hmm. next, like, 5 or 10 years. I think that that's going to be because they're going to take something that is cinematic, but you can't tell in 90 minutes, and make it into, you know, 4 or 5 parts into something really great. I just finished Band of Brothers, so this is why I'm like miniseries.
I'm in the middle of watching The Pacific.
So yeah, I was too shell shocked at that point. I was like,
HBO is doing Mildred Pierce right now.
Right. And what was really interesting is a couple weeks ago, they did a preview of the new episode of Glee when it came back in theaters, right? Which was a really strange experience to watch a TV show with a huge audience of people. And it was actually really cool because not only were you getting all these reactions, you know. And but at the end, it wasn't just finite, like, oh, what happened? It's like, oh, so what's going to happen next week? Like, what's going on? It was just sort of this interesting. I thought, gosh, you know, is this going to be a new thing? Like, what if we were watching Lost week to week and on like a theater or something?
I'd love to see the finale of Lost.
I think they are going to be showing, some theaters will show the finale.
Oh, really?
And there are places like bars and coffee shops that show shows, within a group, so you can have the communal spirit experience.
And actually, there were episodes of Battlestar, like the new Battlestar Galactica, where they did that. They had screenings together, and then the cast came on to talk about it.
That's not cool.
Yeah, and so, but again, it's like that event television where everyone's so invested in sort of what happens. And I think that's a great point about sort of the discourse and what it creates. And I think the best shows do that. I think, you know, The Sopranos is a really interesting show, but the reason it had such staying power is people were invested in the characters and certain the symbolism of the show. Not so much, you know, mysteries, but, you know, what the show meant on a thematic level and things like that.
Yeah. So we talked about some of the little things we like about the show that I suggested we might have as a talking point. Or,
Who had the list of top episodes? Was that?
Yeah.
The one who's the nerdiest Lost fan at the table. That's him.
The Constant.
The Constant's the best episode ever. Yeah. Here's why.
It is. But
let's talk about it.
All right. Well, I think The Constant, it sort of brings it all together in a way. It's about jumping through time, but it's ultimately about a character. And the editing of that episode is just so brilliant. I mean, by that point, we know Desmond and we care about him. We are aware of his relationship with Penny. But the way he jumps through time is important. We know that this is going to be an interesting thing to bring up because we have this new character, Faraday, and he's this scientist guy, but he has his own thing. It seems like he can't remember things, but he has this journal about, you know, all these equations that's very important. And he tells Desmond, you need to find your constant. And sort of the emotional climax of that episode, it's just such a great blend of the show's sci-fi elements, and it's always been a show about time, from flashbacks to flash-forwards, and that, you know, you'd have these two time paths crossing, and that what unites them is, you know, this really, I think, beautiful love story between two characters. So I think that's what makes The Constant sort of the best episode. It's how it all came together perfectly, both the show as a whole and also these characters you really cared about.
One thing that I find fascinating about the character of Desmond is how he's, like, the Joker in the pack of the show and how he's kind of outside the structure of, like, the usual flashbacks with the regular castaways on the island. You know, I mean, I don't know if I have a greater point than that, but it's like the show is like this one thing, and he's in this other kind of story that intersects, you know.
I mean, one of his episodes, you know, character-centric episodes is when, after season two, when he turns the key and he finds himself, it's not a flashback episode. I think the episode's called Flashes Before Your Eyes. And he's going through this timeline, but he's kind of aware of it, and things aren't right, and he encounters Eloise Hawking, who we didn't know who that was at the time.
She's my number one question mark right now. She's everywhere in all times, and she knows and everything.
And
except for there's a point in season five when she's like, "This is the first time when I don't know what's going to happen." And that was a great moment because she has always known everything. And when she says that, you're like, "Oh shit, she knows everything. You know, she doesn't know. We're screwed.
What's going on?"
And all of Desmond's episodes seem to tie into the larger mythology. I mean, not to say like, I mean, I like, for instance, Charlie's episodes. I mean, it was sort of a personal story, and we have those for the individual characters. But Desmond ties into Widmore, and Widmore is such a huge presence, and it's sort of things like that. But the fact that the Desmond episodes have always kept such a great character, and I think Henry Ian Cusack has made him so warm and approachable. And I think that is one of the things that this season six has really thrown us for a loop with Desmond and what his kind of character. And I think that's another reason we're kind of uneasy about him now because, and again, I'm going to
don't give away too much. Russ doesn't know.
Okay, I'm going to stop.
Anything else is fine, but the Desmond stuff is cool.
But it's interesting. But again, that ties into the fact that he is, you know, he's a character sort of in time, but sort of separate from it. And not even he really knows what's happening to him, but we know he's always a character apart.
Number two
would be Walkabout, because that's the episode that, I mean, I liked the pilot a lot. I liked,
remind me what the plots of these are, because I don't know them by title.
Walkabout is the first season episode that gives you John Locke's Oh, yeah, backstory.
Do we see Abaddon in that episode, too?
No, we don't.
We don't see Abaddon until much later.
He's one of my top five, like, why did they take him from me people.
Yeah, well, such a great actor whose name escapes me from The Wire. Lieutenant Daniels.
Yeah, Cedric Daniels?
Lance Reddick.
Lance Reddick, thank you.
And he's in Jonah Hex.
Yeah, I know.
Lucky him.
It was the only good part of that trailer. Anyway, go on.
Anyway.
Sorry, Walkabout.
But Walkabout is... It's another big mythology episode, but you know, Terry O'Quinn just did something really different. And my favorite three episodes have a moment that just sort of crystallizes the show for me in a way. And so with The Constant, it's when him and Penny sort of are finally talking on the phone and just the way it cuts back and forth between them. With Walkabout, it's the reveal that he's in a wheelchair and, you know, just screaming, don't tell me what I can't do. And what's funny it's a great line, but in season six, they brought it all the way back to that's a cry of a feudal man. And in season six, there's this, his alternate self has an acceptance and he's much happier. And so in a weird way, what felt like a moment of defiance in the very first season turned out to be, screaming futility. But back in season one, it made Locke one of the most interesting characters. And we all wanted to know more about him. Like, who's this guy who comes on the island and suddenly he can walk again? And he has
a suitcase full of knives.
You just throw him in at a chair. And it's so cool. So
I just picture Locke's apartment while he's in the wheelchair to just have this wall that's gouged with knife holes where his neighbors are pounding on the ceiling.
In between talking with phone sex lines.
Yeah, exactly.
Trying to have real, not sex, but like phone, just conversations.
Yeah.
Exactly. But he's like, I can afford it. But anyway, to me, that was the episode where I became a hardcore fan of Lost. Mm-hmm. The pilot really hooked me. The Kate episode, sort of like, okay, whatever. I'm still interested.
You have it on mute. You're like,
episode four, Walkabout. And then I'm in it for however long
you
want to take.
Yeah.
For keeps. And then the last episode that's my favorite is Through the Looking Glass Part 2, which is the season finale of season three. Because it's the episode that changed, the narrative device. It's like, now we're doing flash forwards. But... which is very cool. But again, there's this moment. One of my favorite moments is when Charlie finally dies.
Yeah.
And it's the not Penny's boat.
He sucked.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. It's Charlie, went through this.
Shaft is amazing. What are you talking about?
We all want to die in a way like that. Huge heroic.
Right. And I think it's sort of,
Greatest Hits.
Greatest Hits is this really
good episode.
And I think it was a good culmination of an arc. But it's this emotional moment, also involves Desmond, but to me, the moment I really love about it is he puts it up, puts his hand up there, not Penny's boat. It's the last thing he can tell them. And then as he dies, he does this symbol of the cross. He crosses himself, which was such a nice touch for a character whose, religion had been such a important thing. Even, the fact that the heroin was contained in those,
the
Mary statues, almost as if religion were mocking him in a way. So those are my three favorite episodes.
I also want to throw out there, speaking of religion, the show has sort of a strange relationship to religion and spirituality and talking about looking up things on Wikipedia. I mean, a lot of people initially, when we were introduced to the Man in Black, were calling him Esau because of the Jacob thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have noticed... all these biblical allusions. I mean, do you guys think this is something that is just sort of a red herring, or they really are sort of consciously attempting to make a...
I think writers like biblical references.
Yeah.
I think I really do think writers like to make biblical references because it's the oldest story and it does add a layer of depth. As far as a Judeo-Christian sort of actual... part narrative device, I don't think that factors in. I think thematically it's interesting, but I wouldn't say it's, they're... that in the end they'll be like, and it was, and it turns out, Jack is Jesus.
Yeah.
Desmond actually played Jesus in a TV movie, so if anyone is a Messiah complex, it may be him.
Turn the other cheek, brother.
Well, one thing I want to say, just what my and think about what my favorite thing about the show is in a small way, it's the kind of the Dharma Initiative gizmos and the hatches and the films with Pierre Chang. And so whenever I see Pierre Chang in in the show or even in other movies, it's like, it's the creepy Pierre Chang guy. And they would have this, since they were old-fashioned, like, 70s technology that was in this weird place. It was like, it would have this weird mystique about it, and it would seem like we don't know what it's going to do, and it's so old that it might not even do what it's supposed to do. So I never saw much of Alias, but I can imagine there's probably a certain amount of that in Alias, too, J.J. Abrams' previous show, you know?
Well,
but
yeah.
It would, I don't know what it would... It would just sort of... engage my subconscious in a way, almost the sort of creepy technology and
I love
mystery.
That, I love that they have all this technology and that they still have record players.
Yeah, yeah.
You know that speaks to me personally.
Yeah.
I like that aspect.
We have these advanced 8-track tapes here at the Dharma Initiative. Yeah.
Well, I think what's interesting about the Dharma Initiative is that they built technology on top of technology. Like they knew there was this electrum. They knew there was some odd things about this island. Mm-hmm. This is another mystery. I don't think we'll ever find out about like the Hanso Foundation. And
right. We'll never find out who also Alvar Hanso is, probably. And I thought there was a big bad of the show.
Well, there was an alternate reality game that sort of gave, sort of revealed who he was. Mm-hmm. Same with, there was another one that told us what the numbers were. Mm-hmm. But in any event, what I like about the Dharma Initiative is even though in season 5 where we discover that most of them are just a bunch of dipshits.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, the show hates hippies.
Justifiably.
Yeah. They built technology on top of other technology. Mm. You know, they have this, the Orchid Station is on top of the giant donkey wheel that you have to turn.
Yeah.
You
know, the frozen donkey wheel.
The frozen donkey wheel.
And
then you have this lighthouse that, you know, we didn't know about. But again, there are these small technological things on an island that should be nature, but it almost feels like because the island is so old, you know, civilizations far before the Dharma Initiative were still doing technological experiences that tapped into the island.
It reminds me a lot, actually, because when the show first came out, I remember they were likening it a lot to Myst, the old, which I was into Myst and all the sequels and all that. So when I watched, that was the first thing that struck me. And what always creeped me out about Myst was that you had these bizarre things like the old beat up rocket ship and things like that, and these weird clanking sounds and boiler rooms and things. And I was just like, you know, but you're on this island where, like, you know, like you're saying, it's just this, you know, sort of natural thing, but you've got these weird sort of machines built into it. It's a very strange and creepy.
Well, and even the sound of the smoke monster, you know, rather than
the cash register.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a frightening sound.
I really love
sort of sound.
Because there's something mechanical about it that's really frightening. Because, you know, because when you first hear it, you're like, it sort of sounds like a dinosaur, but wearing, like, chainmail. Right. Like, I'm very confused.
1970s steampunk or something.
It is very.
That's something I really liked about the smoke monster. It's like, okay, we can't do some big thing that, you know, we do have a budget here, okay? You've seen the polar bears.
We have it on polar bears.
Yeah, we have a budget. So a smoke monster would actually be pretty easy to render digitally, but it's also something that no one has seen before. There's nothing to compare it to before. Like, I remember back in season 1, it's like, is it a dinosaur? And then later they made fun of it. It's like, no, it's not a dinosaur on the island.
It was kind of like a dinosaur.
It was like a dinosaur in the first episode. You thought it was that. And that's another question. It's like, why did it kill the pilot? And, you know, I think that was back when they didn't know what it was.
Lapidus, right? And he wasn't on the thing, and so the smoke monster was trying to kill everyone that wasn't a candidate, right? So if he wasn't a candidate, but he was the pilot and something, I don't know. Yeah.
There's no answer to that, though.
But, I mean, that's a good argument. I never thought about that.
But if he wants to get off the island, why does he kill a pilot, you know?
I think
I'm not saying it's
well,
of course
no,
that
no,
plane
because
is totally
he was,
broken.
He can't get off the island with Jacob being there. That's the, you know, and that's sort of the interesting thing about the two of them. I'm still in this position of being like, are they this truly paired duo in the sense of order and chaos, or is Jacob more his jailer, you know, and what is the origin of you know, the Man in Black being on those are the questions that I'm still vaguely interested in as far as, okay, what's the real, is there more of an underpinning to their relationship here than we...
I'm waiting for that backstory episode. Better happen.
One of the meanest episodes, one of the meanest descriptions I've heard of them, and I hope it doesn't turn out to be this way, but it's like two roommates having a cosmic argument.
That's what I heard, though. Everything's just a big chess game.
In which case, they would actually both be assholes.
This is the largest scale remake of The Odd Couple.
Yeah. The Odd Couple through time.
That's right.
Well, I think we should wind up a little bit. One thing I just wanted to say is that looking back at the show, I think it's done a really nice job of, like, tying everything up and sustaining the narrative. I was thinking about comparing it to, like, The X-Files, which had this cool mythology that kind of dispersed and the actors left the show and it just kind of went...
Because they weren't allowed to end it.
Yeah.
Fox is like, we can't, you know, even if Chris Carter, even if you want to leave, we're going to do it without you. And so, and of course, Lost changed that and said, no, here's an end point.
And Battlestar Galactica, which is a show I loved, got really convoluted and started adding in all these weird things. And by the end, I was like, I mean, I could appreciate it episode by episode, but it's like, you know, this is just kind of unnecessarily strange, and I don't get it, a lot of this stuff.
And I actually,
Lost, it's like, no, I think this all holds, it's about as good as you could reasonably expect.
Right. And I don't know if any of y'all have seen the Battlestar finale. I know people that hate it and love it. I'm one of the people that love it. I thought, wow, you really did bring it all back together and give it some resonance. And
I'm kind of ambivalent about it.
Okay. So. I really like
but that might be a time for another conversation.
Let's talk Battlestar now. Just keep going. Okay.
Okay.
It's interesting in the sense of, you know, the talking about the X-Files and the way it sort of just petered everything away. You know, a lot of what really worked in the X-Files was these standalone episodes that were sort of contributed a little bit to the show's overall mythology, but were kind of outside of the scope of the primary narrative. And those were always the things there that I really liked. And ironically, in Lost, you know, one of the episodes that I really love is Exposé, which is kind of the series one true standalone episode, you know, where it's about these two characters.
The Nikki and Paolo episode.
What's that? Yeah, exactly.
It's the Nikki and Paolo episode.
And it's kind of a...
It's sort of Hitchcockian.
Yeah, it's kind of like a thriller. It's kind of a heist. And it's, you know, an episode
and
sorely
to... Tales from the Crypt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tales of the Unexpected.
Exactly, yeah. And it's meant to kill off these two characters that nobody liked. But were brought
into the show ill-conceived. Because they're like, we want to see what it's like from other people. And then you have
these
two characters just coming along. It's like, who are you guys?
And you know, the whole episode is Sawyer being like, who the hell are these guys? But it really works as this standalone thing, but that still gets referenced, you know, in season six. Miles references them, you know, because that's just a nice thing about the show, that even the little standalone things where they're sort of like, we're just going to do this one bit here, still contribute to the overall profile and the overall feeling that you're in a place that is whole and that is unified and is well put together, mostly.
I read an interview with one of Darlton who said that they had considered, when they were dealing with Nikki and Paolo, they considered doing an episode about all the flashbacks would be to Nikki's show, because she was like on this like, kind of weird cop show.
Called Exposé.
And you wouldn't know it was a show until the end.
So they
would flashback to these like ridiculous like spy things. And they realized, I think, that it might be a little bit too meta, you know.
Well, I think that also that I remember reading at some point that when they were conceiving of those two characters as actual more long-running members of the show, that her backstory was that it wasn't that, like, that some of that stuff was meant to be kind of her actual backstory, and then they sort of contracted it all when everybody hated them. And it's like, what are these people doing here?
You can sort of see where they've sort of shoehorned in things. I mean, I think, for instance, the actress that plays Sun originally auditioned for Kate, and they liked her so much they created the character of Sun and Jen. So that's why, like, the first few seasons, like, Sun and Jen's episodes are kind of like, okay.
Jack was supposed to die in the first episode. Kate was supposed to be the protagonist, and I believe Brian Burke, who's one of the executive producers and who was at ABC, is like, you can't do this.
Yeah. Right.
The audience will lose you completely. They were trying to get
someone like Michael Keaton to play Jack, who was like a movie star, and then to like kind of pull the rug out from under the audience. But
basically have him be the Janet Leigh.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I mean, definitely, I can understand why, because it would be very cool, sort of like everyone is on the table to be killed. But as an entry point, you're like, well, then how can I invest in anyone if they can all die at any time?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and, you know, there are other things like, you know, as we've talked about, where Mr. Echo is a character that was really cool, but evidently played by an actor that nobody liked, was killed off. And in a fairly crappy end. And then Desmond later takes on some traits that seem to be kind of intended for Echo, where, you know, the whole Desmond sort of seeing the future thing, where you're sort of like, wait, was this a plot line meant for somebody else? And they kind of pull these interesting, like, switches like on the fly where they're like, oh, no, we always kind of meant to do this instead.
And in some ways it really benefits the show. I mean, we talked earlier about Ben, and it was not intended to be a long-running character, and, you know, look what happened.
Yeah. Well, and any good show does that. You know, it thinks on its feet and is able
to keep an ear to the ground to see what fans are kind of saying, and I think a lot of times the show is really meta, and it's sort of, you know, I mean, the Hurley and the red shirt thing, and it's like when they kill off the red shirts, you know, it's like, you know, because they know, and when Frogert was, like, struck down by the flaming arrow, it's like these great little moments because people have been talking about them, and I just feel like they must read the blogs or something. Yeah. And
the name Frogert was on my lips when you said that.
Well, that's, I mean, that's one of my, that's another thing I love about the show is that when they decide to kill somebody, usually they do it in a pretty spectacular fashion. Like, especially with these kind of secondary characters, they're like, okay, they're basically, they're sort of plot advancement slash cannon fodder, but they're really going to be cannon fodder. So Frogert gets this flaming arrow in the chest out of nowhere.
Yeah. And, now arts is a verb. It's they got arts.
Explodes with dynamite.
Although I will say,
there's a callback to that too. I won't elaborate, but
There's more to come with that as you.
Yes. Although it's actually interesting. You mentioned like these spectacular deaths, and someone who has the most unspectacular death is Rousseau. You know, this character we thought would be a much bigger factor, and they just got picked off very quickly.
I don't know. Rousseau is, I mean, Rousseau is a significant presence in the show for quite a while. And, I mean, she doesn't get picked off until, what, the end of season four? I mean, she's around quite a bit.
But that's the point. You thought she should
she should have a bigger death.
She should have a bigger death.
Yeah. Right. She should have gotten a flaming arrow.
I don't know. I mean, it's pretty significant the way, you know, because her death builds to the death of her daughter, and you know, it's like you give Rousseau this big giant death, and then just after that you're gonna kill her daughter with this that turns out to be one of the most emotional turning points in the series, and a turning point for for Ben, one of the biggest characters in the series, and you know, you give her a big death, and then you give Rousseau a big death, and it overshadows this other thing that is much more important in the long run. Yeah. So
anyway, well, it's like it's.
We could go on all day.
Should we even do our picks, or maybe we should save those?
We can save those. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, let's save.
Okay. So, anything else about what we want or don't want? What do we don't want from the finale? Let's end up with that.
I don't want concrete resolutions to everything. You know, I'm a big fan of the finales of The Sopranos and Twin Peaks and things like that. And I would rather be able to keep thinking about this and talking about it with people. And as soon as you define everything, that goes away. Yeah. You know?
Do you guys want the two timelines to exist forever, or do you think one eventually is going to have to?
Well, see, the thing is about the parallel timelines is that the editing of season six so far suggests to me that there is at the very least the potential that characters in the 2007 timeline are aware to some extent of the 2004 timeline. There's just too many half reaction shots as they cut back to 2007. There's too many things that really say there's a level at which these people's consciousness or their psyches are palpably split. I think there's going to be I don't think that it's and it can't do that because the way the show is structured so far is that time is that your consciousness can loop to different points in time, but the time itself is a single thing. So it seems like that's the biggest paradox of the show so far, and it has to necessarily by the rules that the show has set out. It has to be resolved. You can't have two parallel timelines.
I've got this hunch that the characters are going to have a choice whether, you know, do we want to, like, have that be the real timeline or the one we're in the real timeline? Mm. And they'll wrestle with that on the finale. That's just my guess.
The one timeline will be sacrificed for the good of
Yeah, exactly.
That's my assumption.
I have no idea. I have no idea what I'm not good at predicting sort of where things will go, and that's one of the things I really liked about the show. It just keeps me on my toes and it's kept me interested, and I'll just go wherever they want. But I have actually no theories about how it will end, or what I want the most is it's not about answering anything like that. I just really like to see what happens to these characters and that the show remains honest to these characters and respects that we followed them for 6 years and not just shortchange them. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Or a few months in some people's case.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening all the way to the end.
I'm sorry, Allison. You're a special guest.
Oh no, I think I've said it all. Keep reading my blog. Yeah. And I'll keep saying it.
And what's the web address for the blog?
Oh, it's on ScreenGrab on the Crave Living site. What did you know the actual?
I don't recall the actual URL, but if you like Google
televangelist,
it
but will not Tammy Faye Baker.
Yeah, televangelist lost, but again, not Tammy Faye Baker either. It'll come up, yeah. But thank you, Allison. Will you come back sometime if a similar topic comes up?
Yes.
That would be great.
Anytime.
Okay. I'm Matt Goldberg at Collider.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/MattGoldberg, all one word.
And I'm Russ Fisher from SlashFilm.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/RussFisher, all one word, FISCHER.
And I'm Kurt Holman with Creative Loafing, and so thanks for listening to this discussion of Lost. Because every time the title would come up when we watched it, we would say Lost.